the seed and origin of all the ruin and various disasters, putting in turmoil all places with unwanted fires, we have found to be this. The people of the Huns, but little known from ancient records, dwelling beyond the Maeotic Sea, near the ice-bound ocean, exceeding every degree of savagery. The cheeks of the children are deeply furrowed with the steel from their very birth, in order that the growth of hair, when it appears at the proper time, may be checked by the wrinkled scars. They grow old without beards and without any beauty, like eunuchs. They all have compact, strong limbs and thick necks, and are so monstrously ugly and misshapen that one might take them for two-legged beasts. Although they have the form of men, however ugly, they are so hardy in their mode of life that they have no need of fire, nor of savory food, but eat the roots of wild plants and the half-raw flesh of any kind of animal whatsoever, which they put between their thighs and the backs of their horses, and thus warm it a little. They are never protected by any buildings, but they avoid these like tombs. Roaming at large amid the mountains and woods, they learn from the cradle to endure cold, hunger, and thirst. No one in their country ever ploughs a field or touches a plough handle. None of their offspring, when asked, can tell you where he comes from, since he was conceived in one place, born far from there, and brought up still further away. So when the report spread widely among the other Gothic peoples that a race of men hitherto unknown had now arisen from a hidden nook of the earth, like a tempest of snows from the high mountains, and was seizing or destroying everything in its way, the greater part of the people, looking for a home removed from all knowledge of the savages, and after long deliberation what abode to choose, they thought that Thrace offered them a convenient refuge. But the Goths joined with the Huns and the Halani, exceedingly warlike and brave peoples hardened to the difficulties of severe toils, and set up their camp near Perinthus, and reduced to utter ruin the fertile fields which extended far and wide about it, killing or capturing those who dwelt there. From there, they hastened in rapid march to Constantinople, greedy for its vast heaps of treasure, marching in square formations for fear of ambushes, and intending to make many mighty efforts to destroy the famous city. But as they went on, their courage was broken when they beheld the oblong circuit of the walls, the blocks of houses covering a vast space, the beauties of the city beyond their reach, the vast population inhabiting it, and the strait nearby that separates the Pontus from the Aegean. So the Goths destroyed the factories of warlike materials which they were preparing, and after suffering greater losses than they had inflicted, they then departed and spread everywhere over the northern provinces. In war, events of importance are the result of trivial causes. So said Julius Caesar. Misunderstandings when two cultures meet for the first time can quickly turn to battle. A few days later, a common man came to the city from Mictlanhuatla. No one had sent him, none of the officials, he came of his own accord. He went directly to the palace of Moctezuma and said to him, "Our lord and king, forgive my boldness. I am from Mictlanhuatla. When I went to the shores of the great sea, there was a mountain range, or small mountain floating in the midst of the water, and moving here and there without touching the shore. My lord, we have never seen the like of this, although we guard the coast and are always on watch." Moctezuma thanked him and said, "You may rest now." The man who brought the news had no ears, for they had been cut off, and no toes, for they had also been cut off. Moctezuma said, "Take him to the prison and guard him well." Then he called for a priest and appointed him his grand emissary. He said to him, "Go to Cuetlatlan and tell the official in charge of the village that it is true. Strange things have appeared in the great sea. Tell him to investigate these things himself, so as to learn what they may signify. Tell him to do this as quickly as he can, and take the ambassador with you." When they arrived, the envoys spoke with the official in charge there, a man named Pinotl. He listened to them with great attention and then said, "My lords, rest here with me and send your attendants out to the shore." The attendants went out and came back in great haste to report that it was true. They had seen two towers or small mountains floating on the waves, of the sea. The Grand Emissary said to Panottel, "I wish to see these things in person, in order to learn what they are, for I must testify to our Lord as an eyewitness. I will be satisfied with this, and will report to him exactly what I see." Therefore he went out to the shore, and they saw what was floating there, beyond the edges of the water. They also saw that 7 or 8 of the strangers had left in a small boat, and were fishing with hooks and lines. The Grand Emissary climbed up into a broad-limbed tree. From there he saw how the strangers were catching fish, and how, when they were done, they returned to the ship in their small boat. They returned as swiftly as possible to the great city of Tenochtitlan, and reported to Moctezuma what they had observed. "Our Lord and King, it is true that strange people have come to the shores of the great sea. They were fishing from a small boat, some with rods and others with a net. They fished until late, and then they went back to their 2 great towers and climbed up into them. There are about 15 of these people, some with blue jackets, others with red, others with black or green, and still others with jackets of a soiled color, very ugly. There are also a few without jackets. On their heads they wore red handkerchiefs or bonnets of a fine scarlet color, and some wore large round hats, which must have been sunshades. They have very light skin, much lighter than ours. They all have long beards, and their hair only comes to their ears." Moctezuma was downcast when he heard this report, and did not speak a word. In my other account, most excellent prince, I told your majesty of all the cities and towns which until then had offered themselves to your royal service, and which I held subjugated and conquered for you. I also mentioned that I had information of a great lord called Moctezuma, of whom the natives of this country had told me, and who lived, according to their computation of distances, about 90 or 100 leagues from the coast and port where I had disembarked, and that, confiding in the greatness of God and relying to the power of your Highness's royal name, I had decided to go and see him, wherever he might be. I even remember that I offered to accomplish the impossible, for I vowed to your royal highness that I would have him prisoner, or dead, or subject to the royal crown of your majesty. About 1,000 of the principal citizens came out to meet me from the city, and speak to me, all richly dressed alike according to their fashion. There is a wooden bridge, 10 paces broad, in the very outskirts of the city, across an opening in the causeway, where the water may flow in and out as it rises and falls. Having passed this bridge, we were received by that lord, Moctezuma, with about 200 chiefs, all barefooted and dressed in a kind of livery, very rich according to their custom, and some more than others. They approached in 2 processions near the walls of the street, which is very broad and straight and beautiful, and very uniform from one end to the other, being about 2/3 of a league long, and having on both sides very large houses, both dwelling places and mosques. Moctezuma came in the middle of the street with 2 lords, one on the right side and the other on the left. All were dressed in the same manner, except that Moctezuma was shod, and the other lords were barefoot. Each supported him below his arms, and as we approached each other, I descended from my horse and was about to embrace him, but the 2 lords in attendance prevented me with their hands, that I might not touch him, and they, and he also, made the ceremony of kissing the ground. We went on through the streets until we came to a large and handsome house, which he had prepared for our reception. There he took me by the hand and led me to a spacious room, in front of the court where we had entered, where he made me sit on a very rich platform. We have known for a long time, from the chronicles of our forefathers, that neither I nor those who inhabit this country are descendants from the aborigines of it, but from strangers who came to it from very distant parts. And we also hold that our race was brought to these parts by a lord, whose vassals they all were, and who returned to his native country. And we have always held that those who descended from him would come to subjugate this country and us as his vassals, and according to the direction from which you say you come, which is where the sun rises, and from what you tell us of your great lord or king who has sent you here, we believe and hold for certain that he as our rightful sovereign, especially as you tell us that since many days he has had news of us. Since you are in your rightful place and in your own homes, rejoice and rest, free from all the trouble of the journey and wars which you have had. Do not believe more than you see with your own eyes, especially from those who are my enemies and were my vassals, yet rebelled against me on your coming, as they say, in order to help you. I know that they have told you that I have houses with walls of gold, and that the furniture of my halls and the other things of my service were also of gold, and that I am, or make myself, a god, and many other things. The houses you have seen are of lime, and stone, and earth. And then he held up his robes, and showing me his body, he said to me, Look at me, and see that I am flesh and bones, the same as you, and everybody, and that I am mortal and tangible. And touching his arms and body with his hands, Look how they have lied to you. I answered to all he said, certifying that which seemed to be suitable. After this he took his leave, and when he had gone, we were well provided with chickens and bread and fruits and other necessities, especially such as were required. Thus I passed 6 days well provided with everything necessary, and visited by many of the lords. 6 days having passed, most invincible prince, after I had arrived in the city of Temixtitan, and having seen something of it, although little in proportion to the amount there is to be seen and noted, it appeared to me, even from what I had seen of it and the country, that it would be conducive to your Royal Highness's service, and to our security, that Montezuma should be in my power, and not at his entire liberty, so that he might not relax his intention and disposition to serve your Highness. I thought this, especially because we Spaniards are somewhat touchy and importunate, and if he should happen to become angry, he could do us such injury with his great power that there would remain no recollection of us. And so I determined to seize him, and confine him in my quarters, which are very strong. I stationed sufficient guards on the cross streets and went to the palace of Montezuma, as I had at other times gone to see him, and after conversing with him lightly on pleasant subjects, and after he had given me some valuables in gold and one of his daughters and some daughters of other lords to some of my companions, I told him that I had learnt of what had happened in the city of Nautacal or Almería, and about the Spaniards whom they had killed there, and that Qualpopoca gave them his excuse that all he had done had been by Montezuma's order, and that, as his vessel, he could not have done otherwise. I said that he ought to send for him and the other chiefs who had helped him in the murder of the Spaniards, so that the truth might be known, and they be punished, and your Majesty might clearly perceive his good disposition. Otherwise, the reports of these wicked men might provoke your Highness to anger against him, from which, instead of the favours your Highness would now grant him, evil would result, for I was convinced that the truth was contrary to what they declared. He immediately sent for certain of his people, to whom he gave a small stone figure, like a seal, which he wore tied to his arm, ordering them to go to the city of Almería, which is about 60 or 70 leagues from that of Muxtitan, and bring the said Qualpopoca. These men immediately left, and after they had gone, I told Montezuma that I was very grateful to him for the diligence he had used in the imprisonment of these men, for I must render an account to your Royal Highness for those murdered Spaniards. To enable me to give this, it now only remained that he should stop in my quarters until the truth was established, and it was known that he was blameless. I earnestly prayed him not to feel pained at this, because he would not be kept a prisoner, but would have entire liberty, well assured that he should suffer no annoyance or unpleasantness, but rather that, in addition to his own attendants, my companions would also obey his commands. We had much conversation and argument about this, which would be too lengthy to write, as well as little bearing on the case, hence I will not say more than that he finally agreed to come with me. Thus we went to my quarters without causing any commotion in the city, although some had begun, but when Montezuma heard of it, he ordered it to be stopped, and thus all was completely quiet, as though nothing had happened, and this continued all the time I kept Montezuma prisoner. Those who had been sent for Qualpopoca and the others who had killed the Spaniards returned, bringing the said Qualpopoca and one of his sons, and with them 15 other persons, and afterwards they confessed that they had killed the Spaniards. And so I had them interrogated as to whether they were vassals of Montezuma. Qualpopoca answered, asking if there existed any other lord of whom he might be vassal, as much as to say, there was no other. I likewise asked them if what had been done there was by Montezuma's order, and they answered, no. When the sentence, that they should be burned, was carried into execution, all with one voice said it was true that Montezuma had ordered them to do it, and that they had obeyed his command. So they were burned publicly, in one of the squares, without occasioning any commotion, and the day when they were burned, as soon as they confessed that Montezuma commanded them to kill the Spaniards, I ordered him to be put in chains, which frightened him. December 13th. Towards noon, we saw a large, high-lying land, bearing southeast of us at about 15 miles distance. We turned our course to the southeast, making straight for this land. We were about 2 miles off the coast, which showed us a very high, double land, but we could not see the summits of the mountains owing to the clouds. 18th December. At sunset, when it fell calm, we dropped anchor. About an hour after sunset, we saw a number of lights on shore and 4 boats close inshore, 2 of which came towards us. The men in the 2 prows began to call out to us in a rough, hollow voice, but we could not understand a word of what they said. We, however, called out to them in answer, upon which they repeated their cries several times, but came no nearer than a stone shot. They also blew several times on an instrument of which the sound was like that of a Moorish trumpet. We then ordered one of our sailors, who had knowledge of trumpet blowing, to play them some tunes in answer. Those on board the Zeehan ordered their second mate, who had come out to India as a trumpeter, to do the same. After this had been repeated several times on both sides, and as it was getting more and more dark, those in their native prows at last ceased and paddled off. For more security and to be on guard against all accidents, we ordered our men to keep double watches, as we are wont to do when out at sea, and to keep in readiness all necessaries of war, such as muskets, pikes, and cutlasses. December 19th. Early in the morning, a boat manned with 13 natives approached to about a stone's cast from our ships. They called out several times, but we did not understand them, their speech not bearing any resemblance to the vocabulary given us by the Honourable Governor-General and Councillors of India. As far as we could observe, these people were of ordinary height. They had rough voices and strong bones, the colour of their skin being brown and yellow. They wore tufts of black hair right upon the top of their heads, tied fast in the manner of the Japanese at the back of their heads. For clothing, as it seemed to us, some of them wore mats, others cotton stuffs. Almost all of them were naked from the shoulders to the waist. We repeatedly made signs for them to come on board of us, showing them some white linen and some knives that formed part of our cargo. They did not come nearer, however, but at last paddled back to shore. In the meantime, we convened a council and resolved to go as near to the shore as we could, since there was good anchoring around here, and these people apparently sought our friendship. Shortly after we had drawn up this resolution, we saw 7 more boats put off from the shore, one of which, high and pointed in front, manned with 17 natives, paddled round behind the Zeehan, while another, the 13 able-bodied men in her, approached to within 1/2 stone's throw of our ship. The men in these 2 boats now and then called out to each other. We held up and showed them, as before, white linens, but they remained where they were. The skipper of the Zeehan now sent out to them his quartermaster, with her cockboat with 6 paddlers in it, with orders for the second mates that, if these people should offer to come alongside the Zeehan, they should not allow too many of them on board of her. But just as the cockboat of the Zeehan had put off, those in the prow before us, between the 2 ships, began to paddle so furiously towards it that, when they were about halfway slightly nearer to our ship, they struck the Zeehan's cockboat so violently alongside with the stem of that prow that it got a violent lurch, upon which the foremost man in this prow of villains, with a long, blunt pike, thrust the quartermaster in the neck several times with so much force that the poor man fell overboard. Upon this, the other natives, with short, thick clubs and with their paddles, fell upon the men in the cockboat and overcame them by main force, in which fray three of our men were killed and a fourth got mortally wounded through the heavy blows. The quartermaster and two sailors swam to our ship, which they got into alive. After this outrageous and detestable crime, the murderers sent the cockboat adrift, having taken one of the dead bodies into their prow and thrown another into the sea. Ourselves and those on board the Sea Hand, seeing this, diligently fired our muskets and guns, and although we did not hit any of them, the two prows made haste to the shore, where they were out of reach of shot. We now weighed anchor and set sail, since we could not hope to enter into any friendly relations with these people, or to be able to get water or refreshments here. Having weighed anchor and being under sail, we saw 22 prows near the shore, of which 11, swarming with people, were making for our ships. We kept quiet until some of the foremost were within reach of our guns, and then fired one or two shots from the gunroom with our pieces, without however doing them any harm. Those on board the Zeehan also fired, and in the largest prow hit a man who held a small white flag in his hand, who fell down. As soon as they had got this volley, they paddled back to shore with great speed. They remained lying near the shore without visiting us any further. Seeing that the detestable deed of these natives against four men of the Zeehan's crew, perpetrated this morning, must teach us to consider the inhabitants of this country as enemies. Although this land seems to be a very fine country, and we trust that this is the mainland coast of the unknown South Land. You, O King, live beyond the confines of many seas. Nevertheless, impelled by your humble desire to partake of the benefits of our civilization, you have dispatched a mission respectfully bearing your memorial. Your envoy has crossed the seas and paid his respects at my court on the anniversary of my birthday. To show your devotion, you have also sent offerings of your country's produce. In consideration of the fact that your ambassador and his deputy have come a long way with your memorial and tribute, I have shown them high favor and have allowed them to be introduced into my presence. As to your entreaty to send one of your nationals to be accredited to my celestial court and to be in control of your country's trade with China, this request is contrary to all usage of my dynasty and cannot possibly be entertained. Europe consists of many other nations besides your own. If each and all determined to be represented at our court, how could we possibly consent? The thing is utterly impracticable. How can our dynasty alter its whole procedure and system of etiquette established for more than a century in order to meet your individual views? Our dynasty's majestic virtue has penetrated unto every country under heaven, and kings of all nations have offered their costly tribute by land and sea. As your ambassador can see for himself, we possess all things. I set no value on objects strange or ingenious, and I have no use for your country's manufactures. There was therefore no need to import the manufactures of outside barbarians in exchange for our own produce. But as the tea, silk, and porcelain which the Celestial Empire produces are absolute necessities to European nations and to yourselves, we have permitted, as a signal mark of favor, that foreign hongs should be established at Canton. Moreover, our dynasty, swaying the myriad races of the globe, extends the same benevolence towards all. Your England is not the only nation trading at Canton. If other nations, following your bad example, wrongfully importune my ear with further impossible requests, how will it be possible for me to treat them with easy indulgence? Nevertheless, I do not forget the lonely remoteness of your island, cut off from the world by intervening wastes of sea, nor do I overlook your excusable ignorance of the usages of our celestial empire. Regarding your nation's worship of the Lord of Heaven, it is the same religion as the other European nations. Ever since the beginning of history, sage emperors and wise rulers have bestowed on China a moral system and inculcated a code. There has been no hankering after heterodox doctrines. The distinction between Chinese and barbarian is most strict, and your ambassador's request that barbarians shall be given full liberty to disseminate their religion is utterly unreasonable. It may be, O King, that the above proposals have been wantonly made by your ambassador on his own responsibility, or you yourself are ignorant of the dynastic regulations and had no intention of transgressing them when you expressed these wild ideas and hopes. And so if, after the receipt of this explicit decree, you lightly give ear to the representations of your subordinates and allow your barbarian merchants to proceed, the ordinances of the Celestial Empire are strict in the extreme. Your merchants will assuredly never be permitted to land or to reside there, but will be subject to instant expulsion. In that event, your barbarian merchants will have had a very long journey for nothing. Do not say that you are not warned in due time. Tremblingly obey, and show no negligence.